Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Nora Hyman, Associate Professor of Art History, the Catholic University of America, spoke how Louis Maurice Boutet de Monvel, 1850 to 1913, explored the subject of Joan of Arc in several memorable forms, among which are six dazzling paintings in oil and gold leaf, circa 1906 to 1912. Hyman places the artist's treatment of Joan of Arc in its historic context. She analyzes the stylistic origins of the paintings, their genesis in Boutet de Monvel's illustrated book Jeanne d'Arc, 1896, their relationship to an award-winning monumental mural by the same artist, which disappeared in the early 20th century, and the peregrinations of the six paintings from their commission to their current display at the National Gallery of Art. This lecture was given on December 12, 2018, as part of an expert panel on French medievalism at the turn of the 20th century by examining the particular cases of Boutet de Monvel's Jeanne d'Arc book and paintings devoted to Joan of Arc and the greater phenomenon of medievalism during the Belle Époque.
The subject of my paper today is the image of Joan of Arc in the oeuvre of Louis-Maurice Boutet de Monvel. I want to begin chronologically by discussing the beautiful fantasy-like children's book, Jeanne d'Arc, written and illustrated by the artist in 1896. Full of patriotic intensity, religious faith, and social values, it enjoyed swift and enduring popular success in both trade and deluxe editions, becoming an étrenné, a traditional gift, for special occasions in France, and soon the United States as well, after it was published in English the same year, released in over 40 separate publications and six different languages over the past 122 years, it remains today one of the most popular biographies of the Maid of Orleans' life ever written. This enchanting book, the artist's magnum opus, led to two equally masterful completed cycles of paintings by the artist that remain intact in collections in the United States. The first was a set of 38 watercolors completed in 1896 and purchased from the artist's wife in 1920 for the Memorial Art Gallery in Rochester, New York. What we're looking at here are two from this cycle, Introduction to the Dauphin and Before the Doctors. The second suite of works that were produced was a set of six large, resplendent canvases in oil and gold leaf, commissioned by the American collector, one-time U.S. Senator, and Copper King, William A. Clark, now in the collection of this museum. This is one of the paintings from that collection. The book also inspired a commission in 1897 for a set of six or eight, depending on who you ask, monumental murals that Boutet de Monvel was forced to abandon in 1900 due to increasingly ill health. Boutet de Monvel began two or possibly three canvases for this unfinished project. One monumental painting that he was able to complete for this series, Joan of Arc at Chinon, and this is the artist before it in his studio, won the gold medal at the Exposition Universelle of 1900 in Paris and entered the collection of the Art Institute of Chicago in 1911. Here we're looking at an anonymous photograph of the artist in his studio at Nemours. This abandoned commission, given to the artist illustrator by the architect Paul Sidel for murals depicting principal scenes from the life of Joan of Arc along the nave of the new Basilica of Bois Chenu on the remote site of the Maid's visionary encounters with Saints Michael, Catherine, and Margaret in the 1420s, was ultimately given to the artist Lionel Royer, who completed the project in 1913. And here we're looking at a photograph of the basilica under construction and how it appears today on the right. It's in the Vosges, right near the border with Germany. Boutet de Monvel also began, but never completed, a canvas of the Maid's angelic apparitions that came to view for the first time publicly in 2016 when it was purchased at auction from the artist's descendants by the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Orléans, and we're looking at it here. In analyzing the stylistic origins of these paintings and their genesis in Boutet de Monvel's beautiful book, Jeanne d'Arc, and tracing their transatlantic peregrinations, I will endeavor to do two things. One, weigh their impact on both children's book illustrations in synthesizing a global array of stylistic sources, and on the subject and on the subsequent iconographic fortunes of Joan the Maid's life. And actually, I'm going to lower this. I realize I'm sort of standing on tiptoes because Jan stood before me. Should have done this first. Sorry, guys. All right. With the aid of the artist's brush and pen, Joan, I will argue, became a more polyvalent figure, appealing to viewers of all ages and able to straddle both sides, Republican and Royalist, in the wide political and social divide, now known as La Guerre de Deux France, the War of Two Frances, following the devastation of the Franco-Prussian War and the Commune in the 1770s, 1770 to 1771. Last but not least, I want to apprise you of the latest developments in an international effort to solve the many decades old mystery, and that is the whereabouts of Boutet de Montvel's one completed canvas for the Basilica of Boischenu, the mural portraying Joan of Arc at the court of Chinon, after it was deaccessioned by the Art Institute of Chicago in 1950. Its last recorded sighting was in Washington, D.C., on the grounds of my campus, in mid-century. But after this time, the painting appears to have vanished. More on this later. Boutet de Montvel was born in 1850 in Orléans, a town that Jean the Maid of Orléans liberated from the English in 1429, a decisive victory that helped to turn the tide of the Hundred Years' War. We're looking here at three sculptures that can still be found in Orléans that Boutet de Montvel saw. We'll get to that in a moment. The one on the left is in a different location. I'm showing it where it would have stood in Boutet de Montvel's own day. His family moved to, with his parents and eight siblings, moved to Paris when he was 3 years old, but he apparently returned regularly for vacations to Orléans. In 1869, at the age of 19, he began studying in the Paris atelier of the history painter Louis-Henri de Ruder. When war broke out in 1870, Boutet de Montvel joined the Army of the Loire in the defense of France. While serving, he contracted pleurisy. He survived this painful and debilitating illness, but his health was permanently ruined. This is relevant to the trajectory of some of the works we'll talk about today. After his return to civilian life, Boutet de Montvel continued his studies at the Académie Julienne and then the atelier of a number of prominent academicians, including Alexandre Cabanel, Paul Dubois, and Carolus Duran. He first exhibited at the Salon in 1874, and his work met with modest success, winning a bronze medal in 1878 and a silver medal in 1880 for the painting At Left. Early on, he showed particular talent for painting children, and we can see some of that talent in the arresting double portrait of the artist's two sons at the right. Both, by the way, followed their father in his footsteps in becoming artists in adulthood. In his later career, child portraiture became, with book illustration, his bread and butter. These boys, like most of Boutet de Montvel's portraits and illustrations of children, have winsome traits of pert upturned noses, little hands, and little feet. And they also evidence the artist's interest in strong contour lines, the influence in part of Kate Greenaway, whose internationally celebrated illustrations Maurice knew from French editions published by Hachette, as well as the abstracting applications of color and line introduced by Japanese woodblock prints, then enjoying sweeping popularity across Europe. Don't ask me why I picked this one. I just liked it. The ukiyo-e on the left has nothing to do with Boutet de Montvel. By 1880, following the birth of his first child, and just prior to the birth of his second, Boutet de Montvel took up children's book illustration to help support his growing family. His first projects were illustrations for a new children's magazine, Saint Nicolas. His drawings were well received, but the pay was low, and this incited him to consider writing his own works. We're looking at the first one that he produced, which was a smash success, a book of traditional songs for small children, followed by a sequel, Songs of France for little French children, pour les petits Français. The following year, he sent to the Salon a large history painting. We're looking at it now, the apotheosis of the rabble. which broke from edifying tradition in obvious ways. This normally elevated genre is turned now, of history painting, is now turned into biting satire, inspired by the artist's traumatic experience of war and civil unrest a decade earlier. The painting was created a firestorm of criticism. It was seen as implicitly deriding, as indeed it does, radical participants of the Paris Commune. It was seen as being anti-Republican and fearing violent public protest. The assistant director of fine arts threw the painting out of the salon, a relatively unheard of thing. In sympathy for this mistreatment, Boutet de Montvel was invited by Edouard Détaille, a fellow history painter and friend, to find new fellowship in joining the Société des Aquarellistes Françaises, of French watercolorists, even though Maurice was not yet an active watercolorist. This experience was a seminal one. It had a significant effect in two ways. One, turning him away from history painting and towards illustration, and the other, and portrait painting. And also, it encouraged him to take up the medium of watercolor. The inspiration for his book on Joan of Arc and his energies turned towards a number of books in the intervening decade before he produced his book on Joan of Arc came by an account that was published in 1899, on a decision on his having walked through the Tuileries Gardens. You got the quote up here now. It was published in Century Magazine, in which he describes a kind of serendipitous encounter with Emmanuel Frémiet's very famous sculpture that dominates the Place des Pyramides near the Tuileries. And he says this idea came to him like a flash and inspiration, and he was really surprised that no one had done a book on Joan of Arc before. He, in a different publication by the same author, he reflected further that he'd thought about Joan of Arc for a long time, and that indeed as a boy passing his vacations in Orléans, a city full of legends about the saint, as he says, I thought that graceful figure of this warlike young lady with her spiritual bearing was the most beautiful thing in the world. And then in a further amusing anecdote describes eating candy that he bought in Orléans. You can still buy it. The one at the bottom, the coton, is called cotagnac, and it's medieval. It goes all the way back. It was believed in the Middle Ages. It's basically quince jelly that has been cooked down, believed to bring good health and felicitous pregnancies and the like. I mean, it had all kinds of associations attached to it, but you can still buy them mostly as little souvenirs with Joan of Arc's image on them. And he describes how he didn't have a lot of money, so when he'd buy these candies, he'd make them last a long time, carry them around in his pocket, think about Joan of Arc. By the artist's own words, Joan of Arc appears to have represented a young girl full of wonder, grace, spirit, bellicose determination, and beauty. In his watercolors and illustrations, and we're actually looking at a mix of them here, he does a set of watercolors, remember, the same year that he does the book, that are pretty close to the book illustrations, but they are not what the book illustrations are made from. If you line them up side by side, it's clear that he made the watercolors separate from and probably after he did the illustrations for the book. In any case, if we look at these, we can see all these qualities, wonder, grace, spirit, bellicosity, beauty, in spades. We also can see, in looking at these and comparing them to earlier images, prior images of Joan of Arc, and here I'm going to show you three slides of the vast body of Joan of Arc iconography that exists. The one on the left is the earliest image done by the only contemporary in her own day that clearly never saw her, but I draw your attention to the long hair and to how buxom she is with her low-cut dress. I draw your attention to the long hair and the kind of stout figure in the first monument on the Pont d'Orléans, and similarly, how fully mature she seems, and again, this kind of long hair, which is not historically correct, that we see in the print on the left. Next set of images from the 17th and the 18th centuries, we're looking at a sculpture of Joan of Arc that stood up until the French Revolution when it got melted down, and that's Paul Ambroise Slotz's Joan of Arc as Bellona, Rubens and Rubens' Atelier's portrait of Joan of Arc in prayer, and a print, a very beautiful, large-scale print, very finely done, after a painting that was destroyed in the French Revolution that had belonged to Cardinal de Richelieu and his collection, of Joan of Arc as this kind of model of virtue. But in all of these, you know, pay attention to how Joan looks, you know, stout, mature, if not even at times operatic in her bearing. The last set we're looking at are a number of paintings from the 19th century and the one sculpture by Frémiet. The influence of Boutet de Montvel's youthful heroine, in his hands, we see her now as being quite different from this. He, first of all, has read, it seems pretty clear by the ways in which Boutet de Montvel treats the maid. Let's back up and look at them for a moment. He's read the historical record and followed it relatively closely, both in terms of her dress and appearance, her actions, and her accomplishments. He appears to have been familiar with the maid's trial transcripts that were made available in the mid-19th century, 1841 to 1859. They were translated into modern French from the medieval French and from the Latin. And he also focuses, as I think we can see here, on her youth, casting the maid as a slip of a girl, slender, almost cult-like, complete with a, as if she's just on the cusp of puberty, with none of these kind of womanliness that I think we see in it. These earlier portrayals. I could show you many examples of how her image appears prior to Boutet de Montvel, but it's clear that afterwards, the girlishness of her persona is made more dominant, and we can see that certainly in the paintings that were ended up taking the place of Boutet de Montvel's in the Basilica of Joan of Arc in Domremy. We can also see them in a number of other paintings, like Mucha's famous Joan of Arc now at the Met in Art Nouveau, which I'm still kicking myself for forgetting to put into this PowerPoint presentation as I'd intended. Royer's maid, like Boutet de Montvel's, is diminutive, plucky, and of course pious. And I'm showing you two details from these monumental, and it's very hard to photograph these. It's hard to get to Domremy, but it's very hard to photograph them. They are enormous. They're like 20 by 11 feet, and they're very high up underneath clerestory windows, so I apologize for the kind of so-so quality of these images. In 1899, Boutet de Montvel's American publisher, Robert Underwood Johnson, the editor of the Century Company, invited the artist to come to America, and he arranged for a traveling exhibition of 91 works of art by the artist, including his 38 watercolors of the maid's life, and his one completed mural for Domremy. In Chicago, at the Art Institute, in Boston, at the MFA, in Philadelphia, and in New York, possibly other cities as well were on this tour. Johnson also arranged for articles by and about Boutet de Montvel. This is one of them. This is one by Boutet de Montvel that was translated, in which he describes his inspiration and how he regards Joan of Arc. And there were just sort of a barrage of things that came out from Robert Underwood Johnson. He seems to have supported him, Boutet de Montvel, in very direct ways, including acting as an intermediary in the sale of the painting that we're looking at on the left here to Chicago, where it entered their collection in the early 1900s. The trip was a critical success, according to contemporary accounts, and not long after it was completed, the artist reluctantly abandoned his work on the murals for Domremy, though he described the painting we're seeing here later in a 1912 letter to Johnson as the crowning glory of my career. This is the painting that is now missing. During this time, Boutet de Montvel was approached by William A. Clark, a multimillionaire, former copper miner, former senator of Montana, and a rogue and a scoundrel, for a commission of five paintings on the maid's life that was completed between 1906 and 1913 that are now here just a couple galleries down at the National Gallery of Art. What we're seeing is the vision and the inspiration from 1907 to 1909. These are estimates. The records are a little spotty. This was the first in the series that he completed. What I'm showing you is the place that they were destined for, and that is the smoking and billiards room of the Clark House, and which, when you think about it, is really quite strange and interesting and sort of amusing. Why would you commission a set of paintings of a girl, albeit a very historic, very important, you know, change the course of history, sort of important girl, for your billiards room? And the best I can come up with is something like this, that France in the early 19th century represented attainment of culture, represented the apex of greatness in the arts. And he was really a man, as we can see if we read some of the statistics about Clark's folly down below, eager to show that he'd come a very long way away from being a copper miner in the hills of America. In the hills of America. 120 rooms, 31 baths, a concealed railway line down below. On and on. It cost the equivalent of like $6 billion in modern day money. It was a pretty astonishing amount of money. If we look at the paintings that are produced and read how Clark himself is corresponding with then curator of, or then director of, the Corcoran Gallery of Art, where the paintings ultimately went after Clark died, we can see that he was eagerly following how the paintings were received. McGuire writes to Clark from Washington, D.C. Clark at the time was in Paris with his French wife and daughter. The press reports show the first three paintings. These are the ones that we were just looking at. This one, Vision and Inspiration. Second one is The Maid in Armor on Horseback. This is the third, and the second one was her appeal to the Dauphin. That when these were shown together, all three of them at the 1909 Salon, they were seen to be the most distinguished there. Clark wrote back from Paris to boast that Monvel's pictures are the most visited and commended. They are a triumph for the painter. And of course, he's congratulating himself for commissioning them in the process. The artist's influences in these paintings, Japanesma and Greenway, have already been noted, but we could add to this Fra Angelico and Uccello. So let's look at the rest of the series and then make these kinds of comparisons. Here are the last two in this cycle. Again, Turmoil of the Conflict, which we'll look at again in a moment, and The Trial of Joan of Arc, the last in the painted series. The book, of course, brings us all the way up through her tragic ending, Au Boucher, at the stake. Here's a comparison of a detail of Joan of Arc identifying the Dauphin at the court at Chinon, and I'm comparing it to Fra Angelico's The Annunciation. I could compare it to many of them as a source of inspiration in its medievalizing tendencies, but also in the kind of attenuated elegance, which can be a medievalizing aspect as well, of the figures, the women in particular. And I'm comparing now Uccello's Battle of San Romano with a detail of the turmoil of the conflict on the right. These influences, I think, are clear and very well established. What is perhaps a little bit less known is the ways in which these paintings and the book that inspired them were themselves influential. I've already noted the ways in which I think they really radically changed Joan of Arc's iconography, but they were also influential on illustrators. Both Maurice Sendak and Hilary Knight cite Boutet de Monvel in these paintings and the book as direct inspirations in their own work. And so this leaves us really only left to ask, what happened to this painting? What did happen to this painting? When I was writing my first book and completing my dissertation on this subject, it was said that this painting was in a private collection. What I'm showing you here is the registrar's card of the work that was accessioned by the Art Institute of Chicago and then was withdrawn. And it was given to the Archdiocese of the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago, which gave it to a seminary then called the Seminary of St. Mary of the Lakes. It's now a university in Mundelheim, Illinois. And that was sort of where this story ended. When the painting of the uncompleted painting of Joan of Arc's Visions, and again, these are monumental paintings, came up for market and Sotheby's sold it to the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Orléans, it got scholars in Orléans wondering what had happened to the painting that seems to have disappeared, and they tracked it down to Chicago and then to Mundelsheim. Mundelsheim, St. Mary of the Lakes responded by saying, we don't have a single place where you could show a painting of that size. The next thing we know, it appears apparently, and I think I've got the connection, note the name here, of Reverend James Magner, the procurator, that position doesn't exist anymore, of the Catholic University of America. This was when the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception and the university were still one. He had gone, by the way, to the seminary of St. Mary of the Lakes. The evidence that we have that the painting came, which when we first approached the archives and asked them, do you have the painting? Do you have any record of the painting? They insisted the painting had never been here, but they finally found in Salve Regina, which was a fundraising newsletter that came out periodically from the shrine. They're still masters at fundraising, as you'll know if you ever cross their threshold, you'll receive emails for the rest of your known days. The painting, as it's identified in this publication, is hanging over the great vestibule of the shrine. I've been there, it's not there, by the way, leading into the northern crypt, and it's not clear where the painting is now. The archivist is, as usual, I've tried to deal with her over the years, no help at all. I'm hoping perhaps someone in this room can help exercise some leverage over her and force her to open her archives, but the hunt goes on. Although the archivist has denied access to her files, it's almost Christmas, a time of divine intervention. Perhaps a miracle will happen, and this long-lost painting will be found. For now, I would like to think of Boutet de Montvel's vivid portrayals of this medieval heroine's life in light of the little juggler of medieval legend, who captivated the imagination of authors, artists, illustrators, and some scholars, too, across the ages, for both offer a poignant lesson in how the most unlikely vessel, a rustic illiterate, can furnish the means of transcendence, accomplishing redemptive and even miraculous feats through determination in the face of perplexity and steadfast devotion in the face of despair. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.